Sometimes life feels out of our control. We get stuck in trauma, old patterns, and change feels out of reach. Sometimes it feels like fate. We want to help you break out of old, unhelpful patterns and become healthier. We're Fate Resilience, taking control of the outcome.
With licensed therapists, Jennifer Oxford,
Taylor Madsen,
Haley Mayer.
Today we're going to talk about the trauma of being in a relationship with someone that has an addiction and the trauma of having an addiction. The definition of an addiction, a substance addiction, is that there is a tolerance that's built, that it takes more and more of the substance, whether that's, for example, nicotine or alcohol, more and more of that substance in order to achieve the same or similar effect, and withdrawal, that the absence of that substance causes psychological or physical harm. That's kind of just the basic when you're going through substance abuse counseling. That's one definition of addiction.
Even in the world of therapy, Taylor, I think the way you described that was really good, because it still takes into account that there is a lot of controversy and debate that happens amongst therapists of what constitutes as an addiction versus an unhealthy behavior.
Yeah, right? The most recent DSM finally had gambling and video game process addiction. Mm-hmm. But with those, there's not really a tolerance. Yeah. And there's not withdrawal.
Yeah. And there's definitely not like the same danger health-wise, like we're saying about withdrawal. That's one of the big things, especially like we all worked in the field of sexual addiction. And, you know, Taylor and I have definitely looked into some other, you know, means of being able to help those kinds of behaviors too. And I think one of the big things is, you know, when it comes to addiction, something I'll briefly mention is just that idea of withdrawal and how the physical effects on the body and things like that. And that's often one of the black and white ways some people constitute addiction, others it's the behavior. So I think it's great that we're mentioning that there's so many different things with it. What we're going to focus on more is just, I think, the typical traditional value of an addiction and what it plays into when it comes to trauma and abuse and things like that.
I like that we're starting off with this because I think it's important to realize as we talk about the trauma of being in a relationship with an addict that the label of addiction is not always the first place to start. Being aware of the behaviors in the relationship, the safety of the relationship, those are more important. And again, whether the person agrees they have an addiction or not, or you think they have an addiction or not, we're talking about when a behavior starts to disrupt the relationship to the point where it could be harmful. And that's not to say everything is an addiction either. It's just to say that if you don't know whether it's a true addiction or if there's not like a code to say this is an addiction, if you see behaviors that are disruptive to people's lives, then you might be looking at, are they also affecting your relationship? And again, I don't want to go too broad either, but I want to give you that freedom to say, like, I don't know if this applies to me or not. I would just listen and say, take the things that work for you and might help your relationship. And if it doesn't apply to you, then just consider the things that do.
I would also say too, one of the things with that is, bottom line, we're looking at when a value has been crossed and a boundary has been crossed. And I think either way, if we are hearing these kinds of things in a relationship, we need to evaluate what's going on. But I guess getting into the trauma of that, I guess, Taylor, do you want to start with the research you've seen with that?
A really common mentality that people with addictions have is that this is only hurting myself. And the truth is that addiction harms everyone in a relationship with the person with the addiction. Someone with an addiction will go to lengths to protect the addiction at the detriment of the people in their lives. So for example, you might neglect the children, you might neglect your partners in order to engage in the addiction. You might think that you're safe to drive when you're not. That's a really common one. There is selfishness with that, and there's poor boundaries. And so someone with an addiction struggles to be trustworthy and to maintain trust.
A big part of the reason people go deeper into an addiction is to avoid their own pain. And so they're in their limbic brain as they're making decisions. And the first thing that our limbic brain has us do is avoid pain and seek pleasure. And so when we're avoiding pain and seeking pleasure, we start to act in non-rational, but less rational ways, with the definitely less responsible ways, right? So we start to move into what could result in danger, because the avoiding the pain seems more important than avoiding potential danger, because the pain feels so real to the person. And so they're justifying those behaviors out of that belief of either real or perceived pain that they're avoiding.
Yeah, you start to do what looks good and what feels good. Addiction fulfills one or more of three things: either to numb pain, like you were saying, Jen, or to avoid it, to escape your circumstances temporarily, or to live in a fantasy. And it can be all three of those things for people.
And I think that's one of the reasons that their perception, if you're in a relationship with an addict, is usually very different. Because again, the benefits that they're seeing of the addiction come from a very different perspective of the person who's not in the addiction. So for example, when two addicts come together, they may share an addiction and they may go deeper into that addiction and actually support each other in those addictions, because they both are benefiting from that support.
When you don't sit in your pain, or when you're numbing it, you have times of flat affect. You're not showing much emotion. You're not feeling much emotion, which makes it difficult or impossible to empathize. And then when you're not acting out, when you're not using the addiction, you have, this is a pain management term, hyperalgesia, you lose your ability to tolerate pain. And so it becomes hyper sensitive to anything that's going on in your life. And so you become much more reactive, and which also limits your ability to empathize. And so people in romantic partnerships, children of people with addictions, don't know if they're going to be hugged or slapped. Essentially, it creates this really difficult environment of unpredictability. And for attachment to be fostered, you need to have consistency and you need to have empathy.
And I think that brings especially into play, you're speaking with children. And one of the things that comes to mind definitely is, like, you hear about children who were born under the influence because their parents had an addiction behavior they didn't get rid of. Well, primarily the mother, right, didn't get rid of an addiction behavior before they're born. And you're mentioning these things about getting in the way of setting up attachment. And that's why those conditions, a lot of people are like, well, they can detox and they'll be fine later on. It's like, no, but like, what you're describing is that they're already at a disadvantage, like we've talked about in previous episodes, for being younger and not being able to know how to get their own needs met. But then they physically are unable to dysregulate, or not able to regulate, due to the fact of this chemical imbalance and due to the fact of these different things that are happening. And so that's a definitely more extreme example of it. But that's especially when we're talking about addiction and talking about the trauma of it. It really is this idea that we're taking a quintessential part of someone's stability, of someone's regulation, of someone's just being able to, like, we take advantage of feeling calm all the time, right? Like we take advantage of the idea of, you know, that you can feel calm, and we don't think about the implications of, what if I physically couldn't balance? And for those who have addictions and for those who are around them, that trauma of, you know, being unable to find your baseline, that's a huge thing that I think we discount. It's to say, like, well, it wasn't that bad. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't like the extreme. Bottom line, if you emotionally can't have the opportunity to have a baseline, that's a huge disadvantage in the sense of, how are you ever going to find that calming effect? How are you going to work through that? And so again, it's not all is lost, but it's the idea of, that's why this is a big situation. And it's not just, well, my dad was, you know, an alcoholic. Mine was not, personally. So I'm using this as an example.
My dad dabbled in addictions.
There you go. But we have these histories where you hear people, I hear it all the time in my office. Well, I mean, they were, but you know, didn't really affect me. That was their problem. And I often have to be like, I don't think you understand. Like, I'm not trying to make a problem out of nothing, but that was a problem. And that did affect you in much bigger of a way than I think you recognize, because of that lack of being able to find that baseline and that lack of being able to find that just comfort part.
Haley, as you talk about that, I think it's really important that we go back to the basis of emotional regulation is through social learning. And so when you have a parent who can't emotionally regulate, and when the child has to behave a certain way to help the parent emotionally regulate, meaning be quiet, be good, all those things, or they will get a reaction. And Taylor talked about, you know, hugged or slapped. That's not just a physical response. That can also be the emotional response of being hugged or slapped. Thanks for clarifying
that, yeah.
Right? So then we meet with people who were like, oh, well, when my parent was in their addiction, I would go in my room and play. That's a form of being pushed away. And you had emotional needs when you were in your room for hours playing and your parent was drunk or whatever the addiction was, and they weren't being met. And if we go back to attachment, remember, part of what we see is if you didn't have rage about the addiction, you might have apathy about the addiction, which is what Haley's kind of talking about. And you're going to say, it didn't affect me, but it did.
And apathy is not the fact of I'm okay and I'm just letting it not affect me. What Jennifer means by apathy is this idea of, it's almost like, think of we have microphones here. You've unplugged the microphone. It's not that the microphone's not picking up on things. You've just unplugged it so it's not able to pick up on things, right? So apathy is that a whole idea of not just the sound around me is quiet enough that I don't have to pick up on anything. It's the fact that I've literally come and unplugged the microphone so that way it has no possibility, which is a lot safer, right? Like, let's say if someone was doing construction next door, right? If I didn't trust the construction next door, or if I, let's say other way, I did trust the construction next door and I knew I could position my microphone a certain way and I can turn the decibels down a certain amount, then I knew I wouldn't pick up on the sound. I can feel trust and I can regulate through that. But let's say I have no trust in the people next door. I just am like, I'm unplugging the mic. I'm not even going to use it. Not even going to worry about it. That, if it's done out of especially a rash decision, that's so much more of an apathy example than it is about someone who's just trying to protect themselves.
Going back to our emotional episodes, emotions are always messages, they're always information. And if we unplug, then they're just going to build up and there's going to be that dam that eventually is going to break. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the signs, one of the effects of the trauma of being in a relationship with someone with an addiction.
And some people, it takes a very long time for the dam to break. So just because it doesn't break within an hour or two, it doesn't mean that it's never going to. I've got people who decades later are coming in.
And again, because you're learning these things at such a young age, this may be your only awareness. You may not even be realizing that what you're experiencing is abnormal or unmet needs. And that can be really difficult to say, oh, but I felt like everything was okay. Mm-hmm. And the question is, does the limbic system feel like everything's okay? And that may be very different. I had someone ask me recently and say, well, if I just left the environment, shouldn't I be fine? And this is a reminder that trauma happens in the brain. It does happen in physical locations, but it gets stored and processed in the brain. And so if your brain went with you when you left a location, the trauma is still there and needs to be worked on. I want to tie back into this idea of apathy or rage, because when we're talking about attachment, if we go into the idea that addicts, when they're using or not using, might be in deeper states of depression, lethargy, or withdrawal, or their own apathy, that actually becomes this dangerous cyclical pattern in attachment. So if you're being parented or you're in a relationship with this, so either the addict is calm, apathetic, depressed, withdrawn, or they're overly engaged in their addiction. And then they go into kind of that irresponsibility that Taylor talked about. That is a cyclical thing that you can pay attention to, because Because understanding that means that you never truly felt safe. You had to catch good moment.
What I also want to bring up is the generational trauma that happens within addiction history, especially if there is a generational addiction trend. I mean, think about it. We're learning this from our parents who learned from their parents. There's a high correlation when it comes to addiction, not just in the biology of a person.
Right, there's the genetics.
Yeah, there's also just looking at the attachment style, right? If I grow up in a household, let's say I'm four generations back, someone's grown up in a household where addiction is introduced, right? They don't even have to have a history of it themselves, but it's introduced. That attachment style and seeing how that works, someone then has the decision of saying, am I going to go completely against the grain or am I going to follow in this? And a good chance, because especially as we play it out, they usually go with what they see, right? Especially before we had mental health and being able to do things, that's where you see a lot of these addiction type of behaviors. A lot of them bloomed really large when it came to these times that were highly stressed, highly workforce oriented, less about mental health. Then you see this generational pull of addiction going down the generations, which then, of course, we're talking about a biological standpoint of it's gaining momentum. As you see the biological kind of continuing to gain momentum as it going down, you also see this behavioral, though, of saying, again, the apathy, it's so much easier to be apathetic. It's so much easier to, we would call it, quote, numb out, you know, things like that, than it is to address the issue. And especially if you don't see someone who's tried to address the issue, or even better, someone who has an addiction history, who's tried to address it, but just couldn't beat it. And it looked like it was just never going to be able to be worked through. There's a very large chance of that person continuing the cycle. So just generationally, when it comes to addiction, I would say that's one of, I can't speak for it being like the biggest generational thing, but I would say that's one of the bigger ones that you see this being enacted in, especially with addiction trauma, is this idea that it is just so easy to perpetuate because of just how dependency works and how attachment is needed and the lack of it that's given by that. So it just, it's interesting to look at that from a standpoint outside of it. And it's a whole hellhole to live through when you're in it. Absolutely.
Another one of the things that happens in those generational patterns is that poor boundaries are modeled, and not just modeled, but specifically talked about, like, oh, we don't talk about this. Other people wouldn't understand, or just innately, the child knows that their family is different than other families, and there's shame that comes with that. And shame pushes us to hide, like we talked about in the shame episodes. They pick up this kind of pattern of lying by omission, leaving things out, keeping people at arm's length. And that poorly prepares children for romantic relationships later in life. Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that I think, as we go back to this idea of that the addict is in either this pain avoidance or pleasure seeking place, is that because of that, because it's all external, they're looking for pain and pleasure, pain reduction and pleasure seeking from external behaviors or substances, they also start to become abusive in the fact that they believe that everything that is happening to them is someone else's fault. So we see a lot of blame, a lot of guilt tripping, trying to convince you to agree with them or to do what they think you should do to make them comfortable. This can... they're doing this to, again, either pleasure seek or avoid pain in the relationship. So there's not this ability to both hold your own pain. The partner of the addict is expected to hold their pain and the other person's pain in order to be, quote unquote, loving. And that becomes emotionally abusive. We talked about codependence in a previous episode, but this can happen with either passive aggressive or aggressive physical aggression, acting out where we say, oh, you don't love me if you don't do this, or if you loved me, you would do this. Those kinds of things become addictive. Or, I'm sorry, those kinds of things can be abusive, and they build into this pattern of codependency in the relationship where you're, again, not managing just your behavior, but you're managing your partner's behavior as well.
And do you see how with that, especially when it comes to addiction and the behavior of the abuse within that, back to everything else we've had, it's you projecting someone else has to have that power to change your own behaviors, right? You're saying like, you need to do this to make me feel better. You need to do this to make this better. That is all projecting on someone else to be the one, essentially, especially like we're talking about, you know, empowerment dynamic and things like that. And the drama triangle, you're projecting someone else to be caretaker. And when it comes to addiction, they project that the substance, the whatever it is they're addicted to, they're projecting that that is their caretaker, right? That's the only thing that can make them feel better. That's the only thing. And honestly, biologically, yeah, right now that might be the only thing that can make them feel better, right? Withdrawal sucks. Okay. But you're also looking at it and you then make people become those things that are the only things to make you feel better. And there's very little accountability, which is why the cycle continues, is because it's constantly reaching out and looking for additional things to make you feel better rather than you taking that ownership. Because that's where the abuse continues to be perpetuated. That's where it doesn't stop, is because you're constantly trying to involve someone or something else rather than looking inside yourself and looking at what you can do to help regulate that internally.
I like that you brought that up, Haley, because if you kind of look at what Haley talked about at the beginning episode, that if your values are being crossed, right? So if a value is being crossed, that's when the addiction comes in. In the empowerment dynamic, the challenger is often a boundary. It's putting that boundary back in, and it might be a challenge. It might be something you need more skill or ability or coaching in order to overcome. But this idea, if both parties agree the other person can't be in pain because it's unsafe for them to be in pain, now we're in an abusive addiction relationship where everyone's managing this person's behavior, but the behavior is actually unmanageable because there's no pain tolerance. I don't remember the phrase Taylor used, but that was a cool phrase. I got to learn.
Hyperalgesia.
Hyperalgesia.
It's what happens when you use opiates consistently.
Yeah. And that idea of they really don't have any pain tolerance. And then what we see is their partner saying, well, I want to help them out of this addiction. Here's the truth. You can't hold their pain while they're coming out of their addiction. They have to learn to hold their own pain. And it is a difficult process and it will be messy. I was going to relate it to potty training. It's just messy. Learning to hold your own pain is messy.
I think just also to simplify it even more, if you're asking, how do I help my loved one, my person, my, you know, whomever, child even, to get through addiction, I think simply said, you can't, right? You can be a support, but you're not going to be the one who helps them. We always think like, is there some magical speech, like some great movie where it's all of a sudden going to click and that person's going to be like, wow, what you said just hit me. It's not. I mean, sometimes does it happen? Yeah, but that's not because honestly, I think that person was trying to change them. I think that was up to the person who's receiving the message 100%. But, you know, especially when it comes to addiction, you can't do anything to make it all of a sudden change. That's 100% on them. It's back to the idea. Because if you do think you can, you're playing into that idea of I'm going to be their caretaker, which is what they're asking for you to do, right? And you can't play into that role, right? You can't play into that role because that just perpetuates the abuse cycle. And so for what you need to do, you need to decide, how am I going to regulate myself and show that I can, that that's a healthy thing that I can do for myself and make sure that I'm taken care of? And how can I be a coach and be a support in a, you know, non-involvemental way, but they need to learn how to caretake themselves, especially within that scenario.
And that's the best way to approach it, because what helps people move out of their addiction is a mystery. There's a phrase, wrapped in an enigma, shoved through quantum space. Yeah. in substance addiction counseling, we say it takes what it takes. And essentially that means that it's been so different for everyone that there's just no ability to predict what it's going to be. Robert Downey Jr. famously has shared that he ate a Burger King cheeseburger from the gutter and it was so disgusting that he decided to give up drugs.
Which is why in Iron Man, you see him doing that. I guess he like implemented that into the scene so that way he could like pay homage to it.
Yeah, and the first one, he eats two cheeseburgers.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know that, you guys.
Well, you see him like on top of one of the buildings eating a cheeseburger.
I remember the scene now, but I didn't know that's where it was related. Yeah. I do want to...
The second one?
Oh. No, two. He's on top of a building eating a cheeseburger and talking about how life sucks and things like that.
I guess I got to go back and watch it.
You got to, yeah. And that's why he keeps asking for that, I think, is what I was told. But anyways.
I think as we're saying this, one of the things I want to add is that I have not ever seen a situation where someone's loved one can be their coach through recovery of addiction. And I think that's really hard for people. They say, because I love you the most, maybe I should be the one who is coaching you through this. And I would say,
which you're not referencing empowerment dynamic about being a coach to someone. You're mentioning like being someone's sponsor, essentially.
I'm kind of referencing both a little bit. When we are too emotionally engaged in someone, coaching them is not the best option for us. It's the same reason that we shouldn't be our family's therapist. We need enough emotional distance to have the ability to see things clearly. And it's really important to understand, and I've seen this with parents, I've seen this with partners, sometimes they say, well, I love them the most, so I'm the best one to do this. And that actually can be hard, because sometimes what it takes to get out of the addiction is to allow pain tolerance to develop, or distress tolerance is another term that we use. And in doing that, we're pushing people past their comfort zones. And that is a hard place unless you are committed fully to the process. It's a hard thing to watch your loved one go through. So it's often best to let someone else do that.
See, and this is from Therapist Haley. You can be a coach empowerment dynamic stance with someone in addiction, but you can't be their sponsor. You can't be their one that they're talking to, more in the sense of you're not continuing. There's nothing within the empowerment dynamic saying that you have to be the one who's constantly being coached to someone. It just means within that
circle. And what you mean, Haley, is like, what are you going to do about it? Like,
yeah. Being a coach, I can be a coach in the empowerment dynamic with someone who's close to me, because they're looking at me and saying, but you need to help me. And I can look at them and say, what are you going to do about it? What are your things you're going to do? You got to go find that answer. And that's me being a coach and not being, well, I could tell you exactly what to do. Cause that would be
being the person that's like, okay, you respond to me. We take drug tests together.
That's not being a coach. That's 100% being a caretaker. But if I'm looking at that person who's coming to me and saying, I need you, I would say, you need to figure that out for yourself. That's being a coach, as in definition of empowerment dynamic, but it's not being a sponsor. It's not being the person who's now in charge of that. So you can 100% be empowerment dynamic coach role, or coach. You can say things in a coach way, but you do not, like, the minute you start becoming the quintessential coach of, I'm going to do this and we can do this together, and that, you've crossed into caretaker, you've crossed into boundary. So I'd say definitely having coach verbalisms, you can 100% keep with people who are next to you. Having anything in the sense of what you hear today as being a way of, I'm going to coach them through this, 100% not able to do with someone that you are that close to for an addiction.
Especially if you have been their caretaker, because shifting back into the role of victim caretaker or persecutor caretaker becomes very easy because of the level of emotional attachment and the history of addiction, or sorry, the history of abuse that might have gone on through the codependence. And so, yes, I agree. Anyone can make a positive coaching comment. I would say, if you're at that level of addiction, invite someone else to help you, because in moving out of caretaker, that is your own recovery process too. It is hard to move out of caretaker. It is not this simple thing where you can just turn on the right words. Mm-hmm. It is an emotional process to disengage and be willing to let someone struggle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes sense. So I would say this is one that is definitely, like with any other thing that we've talked about thus far, not everyone's going to have an experience with this. Not everyone's going to have a personal history with this. And that's great. But for those who do, it's good to understand where it's coming from. And again, not to all of a sudden, because I mean, we could also turn this into saying like the trauma of, you know, what started someone to be an abuser. We've already gone over that. We can totally discuss that. But at the same time, I think we're just laying out what these things look like. So that way people can identify and say, okay, I've wanted to kind of have some closure of what this is. And so again, this isn't, it's gonna not gonna apply to everyone, and that's fine. That's why we have pick and tell, and you decide what you want to do with all these episodes kind of thing. But just so you can identify what addiction trauma does to those who are around you, it's good to have that info.
I think it's important that we do validate that we know that addiction often comes from, you know, pleasure seeking or not being able to tolerate pain, which means that it often came from a traumatized place. But avoiding dealing with the emotion is not the way to heal your trauma.
Thanks for listening. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Please feel free to rate, subscribe, and review. And if you want to find us on social media, we're on Instagram and Facebook at Fate Resilience. We'd love to hear from you.